your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to the Alchemy Podcast, where we're on a quest to explore the intersection of cannabis, compliance, and creative in the marketing world today and beyond. Welcome back to Alchemy. Excited today to share the mic with Jordan Lambs, founder and CEO at Moxie. Jordan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So Jordan, you were recognized recently by High Times as the top 100 most influential people in cannabis. And you also received recognition from Entrepreneur Magazine as a leader in the sector. And, you know, you expanded the Moxie brand from a self-financed startup to over four domestic markets and products across over 40 countries. So congratulations on all these great things.
Thank you so much. It's an honor just to be a part of the movement.
It's fantastic. And I think you've done a tremendous amount of work in a very short period of time. So I think just to kick things off for the folks that are listening in now, like, let's start with Moxie. Maybe talk to us a little bit about the brand and the story and the vision.
Sure. So Moxie is a concentrate-centric consumer packaged goods cannabis brand. We're really one of the very early ones to that sector. And it stemmed from really four friends and coworkers that through several different permutations had all worked together in cannabis for a number of years. And through, you know, various shifts within the marketplace and opportunities opening up, we came together to build Moxie. And it was really under the auspice of that we wanted a brand that stood for great high quality and for good ethics and spirit, that, you know, could conduct business in a way that people respected and was above reproach, but also that could just bring some consistency to the supply chain around some of the more complex value add products. So, you know, when we first started, there were very few people making concentrates in the cannabis space, let alone branding it and putting it out in, you know, regularity with a reliable assortment across geographies. And so we were very early to that game. And really, it started just that we wanted to make products that we wanted to use ourselves. And that still stands today.
That's awesome. So maybe for some of the newbies who are listening right now, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what exactly are concentrates and what's the demand for them in the market?
Sure. So concentrates are the, you know, extracted cannabinoids, terpenes, flavonoids, esters, basically the inactive ingredients like THC and CBD, as well as all of the flavor and aromatic compounds that give a strain its character. The you know, common misconception about the idea behind indica, sativa, and hybrid is that dictates the effect and the strain type, when really that's just related to plant morphology and how a plant grows or where it comes from geographically. The aromatic compounds and the way that they interact with the ratio of cannabinoids within the plant is what really gives a strain its character. What makes Bubba Kush Bubba Kush, or Super Lemon Haze Super Lemon Haze. And so by extracting all of those ingredients down and concentrating them into a homogeneous solution, you end up with really the just true, pure, beautiful essence of the plant, without all of the plant material and the chlorophyll and all of that. Not to downplay the wonderful experience that comes with enjoying cannabis flower, but you get more of a hyperbolic representation of what the strain is. And so the very first product we ever put out, which is still a cornerstone product in our assortment today, is called Batter, or in the old days it was called Wax or Earwax. And that's just an extract made using a hydrocarbon extraction that's then whipped or agitated to polymerize all of the cannabinoids together into like a cakey, wet, creamy consistency that is one of the more sought after consistencies for connoisseurs for dabbing, because it's like the perfect balance of flavor and potency. And so that's where we got our start. It has expanded pretty incredibly since then into other products, other categories. We just launched edibles for the first time a few weeks ago, and that's something we're super excited about. But yeah,
how is that going as you're kind of expanding into, let's just say, a new product category?
Well, I think just like anything in this industry, every step you take, you realize how much farther you have to go. And one of the things in our culture at the company that, you know, I think makes us really awesome is that we're never satisfied. So anytime we get something out, even if it is really good, we're always just looking at like, well, we could do this different. We could do that different. So edibles have certainly been been no exception to that rule, but so far so good. It's a very competitive segment of the marketplace, but we're pretty happy with what we're putting out and also what we've got coming out of the pipeline.
Awesome. So I think just maybe going back for a second to concentrates, because I think you started talking about some very interesting points as far as terpenes and flavors and all of that. You know, how is that? So how do certain plants actually have, you know, a citrus or a pineapple, or like, where do they get those flavors from? Is it the different strains of the plant? Is it soil? Is it conditions?
It's first and foremost, primarily in the genetics of the plant. You know, inputs, environment, soil, nutrients, and even the water can certainly have an impact on that, but usually to have minor directional changes or to exemplify or downplay certain parts of the aromatic profile. What makes it have that, you know, just overt smell of, say, pineapples, for instance, is really it's in the genetic code. And that's one of the things that's so fun about cannabis and that we've really done a lot over the years too, is that you can make stuff by crossbreeding different strains, playing them down, isolating specific traits, breeding them further. And it's kind of like this endless development cycle that's completely natural. And being able to play a hand in that, it's in the breeding process, what I'm describing, is just one of the most miraculous components of cannabis, because anyone can do it. Not everyone can do it well, but what you can do and change about this plant and about strains just really feels like it's limitless. And that's why there's so regularly some new trending strain and some new terpene profile that it, you know, is something that no one's ever experienced before. And, you know, everything from umami to sweetness to savory to smoky, and then some of the more cannabis specific adjectives like hazy or cushy. This broad world of sensory activation that I frankly have not found in anything else on the planet.
Do you think that, you know, if we look at the food and the wine space right now, obviously wine connoisseurs and, you know, sommeliers can really, like, you know, drill down into a flavor like this is tar, burnt wood, or, you know, little notes of cherry. And now I'm thinking with all of these different terpenes, like, would a chef be able to create lots of different types of products based on the concentrate, and, you know, not on a very, I guess, potent level, but just to really understand the flavor profiles? I'm sure people must be doing that now, right?
Yeah, they definitely are. And I think there's definitely that application to it. Although what's really interesting about cannabis is that the rate of occurrence of these flavor and aromatic compounds, like the percentage of which they occur by volume or by mass in the cannabis flower, really seems to be at ratios that were designed to be vaporized or smoked, because eating cannabis does not have the same flavor as smoking it. And when you smoke it is really when you get those flavors that are so much more discernible to other things that it tastes like outside of the cannabis experience. For instance, like an excellent strain to represent of this is Banana OG, right? It's called Banana OG, but it really earns its namesake because that terpene profile tastes like a synthetic banana flavor that you'd put into a candy. But it does that when it's vaporized, not when you eat it. So yes, are people doing that in the food space and chefs, you know, kind of mixing these things in, but it doesn't quite, at least for me, have that same, for lack of a better term, magical sensory experience as when you inhale it, which is very funny and kind of lends to the belief that this plant is actually, you know, for use through inhalation. And I think on the medical side of things, you know, the anecdotal evidence out of there really would suggest that that is the case.
I feel like there's got to be more brands and more companies need to do a better job of explaining the flavor profiles, because I see so much packaging out there that, you know, talks about the flavor, but it doesn't really go into any detail. So for somebody who's just getting started or kind of curious or whatever, I think a lot of people kind of are scratching their head saying, well, is this added? Is it part of the plant? You know, I feel like there could be a whole, there's like almost could be a, you know, when you read a book and then you open the inside cover and it gives you a little bit of a summary, I feel like that could be a good step for a lot of companies.
Yeah. And, you know, I think maybe part of what's really driving poor education when it comes to that is that there's still just like so much we don't know. Like if you look at, you know, bioregulation, which is what drives all of the testing within the space, very little is being driven by research and development. the compounds that we have to test for from a regulatory standpoint are just like a tiny little snapshot of really everything that's contributing to the actual flavor and aroma. And I think an excellent case in point in that is Kush strains or OG strains, where they've got this like skunky lemon pine salt terpene profile that's one, very, very obvious, and two, also very popular. But we really haven't, from the analytical side, been able to distill what makes that profile the way that it is down to the ratio of individual chemicals. So you end up with this very fractured understanding of why things are the way that they are. And so it becomes maybe a little bit difficult to educate accurately, because there's still just this huge, at least from my perception, this huge chunk of information, you know, all these pieces to the puzzle that are really missing. Some strains it's easier, you know, like hazy strains, you could say that, you know, terpinolene is the primary driver of that hazy aromatic profile. But that's just kind of one category of hundreds, if not thousands, of different types of strains that you could group together by the way that they smell or taste. So I agree, but I think we just have so much more to learn.
Yeah. It's a crazy world. So, you know, going back to Moxie for a second, you know, I think one thing that I was pretty blown away by is, you know, you guys have literally been awarded by over 80 different cannabis awards, which is pretty amazing. What are you guys putting in your product?
You know, a little bit of magic, a little bit of hypnosis.
Exactly.
You know, it goes back to what I was mentioning earlier, what made us start the business, which is that we just wanted to make products that we ourselves wanted to use. And because we've all, you know, that founded the business, been involved in cannabis for so long, we have enough of a knowledge to know when something's pretty good or not. And by committing to just, you know, only making stuff that was really good, which is easier said than done, you know, people latched on to that. And I think it's actually over 90 now. I think we're scraping the bottom of 100. And I think the other, you know, simple comment to that is, you know, just participate. Be out there. You know, it wasn't from the beginning of our involvement in the space that we were putting ourselves out there in a way that we could be recognized. It was after, I think, you know, enough percolation in the lab and time refining our craft that then we decided we were ready to participate. And we didn't have success at first winning a recognition. It took time. We had to refine the strategy and understand what people were looking for relative to what it is we thought they wanted. And there's a little bit of an art in curating a menu, not only for retail or wholesale, but also for competition.
And sure,
we've had a long run to do that too, you know, having been involved in it as long as we have.
So, you know, from a just kind of getting started and building, you know, you guys over there obviously have done a really tremendous job, but you also started this from a self-financing perspective, and from a startup to distributing to over 40 countries is pretty massive. So if you could talk a little bit about the strategy, both for the domestic side, international side, and, you know, there's a lot of people I'm sure that are listening to the show and really want to understand, like, hey, what's the approach for market expansion? How do I basically fall in line with compliance and brand development? Like, there's a lot that go into creating a massive brand.
Yeah, you know, maybe cheesy or cliche as it may sound, it really does start by having your mission, vision, and values clear. And that may evolve over time as the world changes. I think that's ever relevant now during the coronavirus pandemic, as we're all having to be incredibly agile and you know, able to pivot certain business decisions at the drop of a hat. But for us, you know, it started with, you know, kind of as we discussed earlier, making sure that one, everything we made was what we ourselves wanted to use. So it didn't become about, you know, selling or marketing. It just was about sharing, just sharing what we loved. But also, we always had the mindset that we wanted to do this forever, and that we had to set something up that could withstand the test of time. And that meant, you know, as I mentioned earlier, too, the value system with which we operate, which is that, you know, we want to be looked at as being good, high quality business people and people. And that means conducting business with, you know, a higher standard of ethics and consideration for those around you. And that's tested every day, especially in a global crisis like coronavirus. And then, you know, being able to be, as I said, agile and nimble. and adjust because the world changes. But, you know, as long as we played by the rules from Jump Street and, you know, took care of our people and those around us and made great products, we kind of figured everything else would always work itself out with enough, you know, good old fashioned elbow grease. And so far, so good.
Absolutely. So, you know, to kind of, while we're talking about it, I think, you know, this is obviously a topic of conversation every day, every hour, every second. You know, everyone's, you know, constantly trying to figure out, how do we adapt? How do we change? You know, coronavirus has really impacted every single person in the world, every business, you know, and I think I've had people on the show every day this week and everyone has a different story. But I'm just curious on your end, like, how has it impacted your business? You know, we're seeing obviously a lot of the dispensaries are on overdrive right now, just trying to keep products on the shelf and changing the way people are buying the products with curbside and delivery. Just curious what's going on with you guys, you know, and if there's been any impact.
Yeah, I mean, I would say almost every aspect of the business has been impacted one way or another. Because we're across a couple different states, it's been very disparate. For instance, in Nevada, the governor a couple weeks ago ordered that everybody move to delivery only sales. So that brought, you know, the entire market to a temporary screeching halt while everybody had to ramp up a delivery infrastructure. And so now we're starting to see that activate and people really come online and shift the way that the culture of consumerism in that market thinks, because it really was not at all a delivery centric market relative to, say, like the Bay Area or parts of California where delivery is very heavily utilized. In California, it's been, you know, I would say lumpy. You know, people are like, okay, we're going hard, we're going slow, we're going hard, we're going slow.
It's crazy.
You got to be able to you know, bob and weave with that, because it's likely to be like that, as we're still, unfortunately, probably at the beginning stages of the effects of this pandemic. Even after, you know, quarantine is over and the health component is not the primary concern, it will shift to the other impacts that this is having on a global scale right now.
I mean, yes. And I think the kind of breaks on, breaks off is happening even today. You know, in California, there was a couple of counties, I think it was Santa Clara, that I saw, you know, while they were open, now they're closing. And there's just a lot of back and forth. And, you know, it's hard to follow everything. And it's hard for everybody to keep changing their business model every day. Crazy times.
Yep, it really is. And I think, you know, I wake up every day just feeling blessed that we get to operate, you know, because I can remember so long ago when every drive home was looking in the rearview mirror with a very nervous demeanor, and now we're considered essential services. So one, it is actually an opportunity to really revel in the progress that we've made collectively. And that's humbling to be a part of. And then just to even be able to provide work to people while, you know, I think this last week, 6.6 million people hit the unemployment line. That's not even reflecting the entire impact of layoffs globally. And it's very saddening to see that happen, but incredible to be a part of a situation where people still get to show up every day. And not only what they're showing up for, to put, you know, food on the table, but is also providing real relief and solidarity for the rest of those out there in the world. And so where we've been at is, like, you know, obviously we're doing the little things that we can, like making masks and making hand sanitizer for hospitals and the kind of obvious stuff. But we've really, every day we're checking ourselves, like, okay, we're in such a privileged position to be able to put the key in the door every day. What more can we do? Mm-hmm. You know, we're coming up with stuff every day that we hope will be meaningfully impactful for our locales in which we operate.
That's awesome. So I want to, you know, jump a little bit over to talking about licensing. So, you know, I think from a Moxie perspective, like, you guys were in the game really early. And I think you were awarded, like, what, the first and second state licenses in California?
Yeah, our original license for California is the first one ever issued. It was actually 00000001. It was pretty sweet.
That's unbelievable. And then you were also one of the first 12 in Pennsylvania. So I think, you know, talking to us about the process and also, you know, the importance of, you know, relationship building, especially in the industry, would be great insight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, getting involved early with the regulatory process is what's proven to be the most fruitful for us. We you know, set out with the mission that, like, look, we love the opportunity for a license and we expect that, you know, we're going to compete just like everyone else. But regardless of that, we want to be involved in the thinking around how the framework gets set up to ensure that even if we aren't a lucky license holder, that the program will be successful. And both in California and Pennsylvania, that proved to not only, you know, be a helpful part of the process for us and the regulators, but also put us in a position where we had some credibility earned that, you know, we were here for the right reasons, that we knew what we were talking about, at least to some extent. And those in power, the decision makers, I think, recognize that, because what we don't do is play the political game. We don't, you know, go about making contributions and whining and dining and flexing relationships. We try to let the authenticity of our intent and our desire for the industry at large to carry what our real mission is. And that has been recognized in some areas and not in others too. You know, we're not like anyone else where we win everything. We've had plenty of losses to get where we are, that's for sure. But we've also been fortunate enough to be given the opportunities that we have.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, you guys have obviously done a tremendous job and, you know, clearly, you know, great reputation. And I think also really great for the industry as, you know, the cannabis space really starts becoming more into, let's just say, a normalization factor as we kind of move into more states coming on board. So this is, you've provided us with amazing insight. And we're part of the show right now where we talk a little bit about business in the beginning, and then we kind of switch over to some quick fire questions, and they're super easy. So, you know, the way it works is I ask you a question and you just, the first answer that comes to your mind. Are you ready?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so first question. Would you rather come face to face with a miniature hippopotamus or a giant cockroach the size of a human? And both are in a really bad mood.
Definitely the hippopotamus.
I was going to say the same thing, actually. When you're on a plane, like, remember that time when we actually could fly, do you wear a neck pillow?
I don't. I have had a collection of neck pillows over the years because I fly so much. I probably have like 6 or 7, but the one I'm on right now looks like a blindfold, but it has little drawstrings on the side. So you attach it to the headrest behind the seat and then it ratchets your head up so that you can't do the old neck nod thing that ends up waking you up.
Oh, I haven't seen that before.
Yep. It's called the Nod Pod. Shout out Nod Pod.
Nod Pod. I'm going to have to check that out. Awesome. LA or New York?
LA all day.
Hey, got a New Yorker over here. Although LA is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I've lived in both. I love New York for a few days. Living there for 4.5 years, I got my fill. I do love the city, but the frenetic energy and the claustrophobia to me is a deal killer when I've got, you know, sunny and 75, 360 days a year.
It is true. Would you eat a day-old taquito from 7-Eleven?
No.
Good answer. Favorite type of muffin?
Blueberry.
Favorite junk food?
Like fast food or bagged junk food candy?
I mean, yeah, junk food is, I would say fast food is junk food.
Probably Canes, Raisin Canes.
Interesting. Favorite childhood TV show?
Ooh, Hey Arnold.
Dark chocolate or milk chocolate?
Milk chocolate.
Favorite cannabis product?
It changes so regularly. I'm a big believer in mixing it up all the time. So sometimes I go on a concentrate kick for months on end, and other times, like right now, I'd say my favorite cannabis product is a backwood of some good flower. Right now I'm smoking on Triple XOG.
Awesome. Well, Jordan, this was great and fun, and, you know, congrats on all the success and all the awards and all the recent news. And, you know, I'll be following you guys and seeing what the next big move is for you.
Hey, much appreciated, Jeff. Thank you for having me on. It was fun.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.